Last week, I sped up a little bit at the end to make sure that we had a good foundation for tonight. We talked about three or four basic things last time. So if you were with us, if you were not with us, here's kind of what we looked at. We talked about two personalities, the first one being John, the second one being Michael. We talked about the fact that the person who's identified as John, he was thinking about suicide, had a shotgun, and considering the ending of his life. We also made the point that when you look at this book, it is about backsliding, and there's a lot of information in here as far as scriptural information when it comes to slipping back into sin. There's also information in here as far as what people have actually done that's caused them to slide back into sin. And then where we left off last week was evangelistic zeal. And tonight, that's where we pick up. Michael, after he became a Christian, didn't take very long before he got the bug to go out and teach others. And they had something taking place. This is on page 29, and he was enthused about it. Mentions the previous 4 months of trying to evangelize had proven to be both exciting and bizarre. They had an annual spring block party. Now, we've not lived in too many places that had a block party or something where the people in the subdivision or in the local area got together. We're starting to see a little bit more of that in our subdivision right now. They put in a big fire pit. And some of the people that I had hoped to reach seem like they're being driven further away. It looks like that's going to be a place where they're going to set up some chairs, and on some of the nicer nights, they're going to have a big beer drinking party over there. They've already had at least two fires, and that's really popular. They can kind of, on a Friday or Saturday night, come together and shoot the bull and share some stories as far as what work is like, and some of the guys are business owners, and it's just a nice time for them to relax. And it's hard to compete in that kind of environment. And that's kind of what's going on here, at least to a certain degree. He says his wife mingled, drank iced tea, and waited. He said, I couldn't start the film strips until dark. Now, if you were not here last week, we talked about the fact that there were some film strips that he had access to, film strips that would teach people the basics about Christianity, five film strips that were designed to take people through the Bible, show them what the Bible was about, show them information about the church, give them information about salvation and so forth. And they had seen those to become Christians. Now they wanted to share those with others. And he's thinking this big block party where people are drinking beer is going to provide them an opportunity to do that. He says his nerves were on edge. That's, I think, a good reminder. A lot of times Christians have good intentions and they want to do what's right. They strive to do what's right. But as they think about talking to somebody or giving something to someone or initiating a conversation, sometimes they're nervous. If you've had that experience, that's not anything that's bad with you or wrong with you, and it's not a lack of maturity. Sometimes that's just the way things are. He mentions the crowd had grown throughout the evening. There were about 100 people there. One fellow was playing on a boombox, John Mellencamp. That was over by the pool. Most of the food was gone, but it always seems like people continue to have beer, and that was true on this occasion. He said, I fought the urge to drink. A cold beer sounded so good. He'll deal with this a little bit more in the next paragraph, but we've often made the point that when a person becomes a Christian, what happens to the desire for sin? It's still there. Whatever was attractive before, there's no magic pill that you take when you're baptized, and all of a sudden it goes away. In fact, the struggle might even increase some because you're thinking, I would have naturally done that before. Now I'm trying to battle that and kill that off, if you will, from my life to destroy that, and that's really a struggle. He says, rightly, temptation doesn't leave you after you've been buried with Christ. Actually, sometimes it can become worse. He makes the point from James chapter 1, 14 and 15, but every man is tempted when he's drawn away from his own lust and enticed. Then the lust, when it's conceived, it brings forth sin. Sin, when it's finished or full grown, brings forth death. So he talks about this big beer party. This was going to serve as the initiation for their evangelistic efforts. Wife is over there talking to some friends. He goes over to the trunk of the car, gets out the equipment, and then start setting things up. He says at the bottom of 29 and the top of 30, over there at the south end of the party area, far away from the swimming pool with intoxicated partygoers and bikini-clad women. That reminded me, you may or may not have seen this, it's maybe fallen out of popularity a little bit, but anybody remember the bar evangelism that was being discussed a year or two ago? Okay, a couple. They were talking about the fact that Sunday morning, a lot of people, if they're not sleeping in, they're going to be down at some bar. So let's go down to where the people are And at least in some cases, I think they were actually drinking with those who were drinking. And it was, we're going to come in here and meet you where you are. And in principle, there's nothing wrong with that. You do need to meet people where they are. But the idea that you're going to go into a bar and get into what we might refer to as the gutter with those folks in hopes of bringing them out, that doesn't make much sense. But anyway, that's not quite what this fellow was trying to do, but that's what it reminded me of. Skipping the next paragraph, he says, "Can I have your attention?" He's addressing the crowd. "I beckoned to the people who were there, motioning for one of the drunks to turn down the music. He was kind enough to try to find the volume knob, but finally he just yanked the power cord out of the boombox. Shank's wife was handing out the booklets to the crowd while I spoke. The expressions on their faces were a mix of shock and confusion." Here's what Shank said. "Most of you know me." "What's going on, Shank?" one of the guys loudly interrupted somewhere from the crowd. "I'm going to show you something that's going to change your life." Well, you can see how naive he was. Good heart and good intentions. But sometimes you're dealing with people who simply have no interest, and that's what was occurring here. He goes on to say, "Do we got to stop drinking?" Female voice, question, and the crowd roared with laughter. I stammered, and the laughter increased. "Well, go ahead and drink. Just shut up and listen." Next page, to my surprise, the crowd grew deathly quiet. I switched on the projector and pushed the play button on the cassette player. The screen lit up, and then you've got the information from the boombox coming forth. Wow, 100 drunks watching the first lesson of the Bible study. The one-hour film strip finally ended. I stood up and turned around to face the crowd, expecting to announce the date, time, and location of film strip number 2, and again, thinking that about 100 people are going to come back for the second time as well. But what had happened to the crowd? Yeah, everybody didn't stay. They headed home. And, yeah, he says that there were 6 people left. So the workbooks, they were strewn across the complex's manicured lawn. He looked at his wife feeling like he was about ready to break down in tears, and she said, "It's okay, I love you." In the excitement, you have him admitting that he hadn't paid attention to the mass exodus of the crowd. He says the remaining 6 were kind-hearted neighbors who said that they would come back when the next film strip was presented. How many came back? Zip. And how many more block parties did he get invited to? Zip. And that happens when you're a Christian. You are going to lose some friends if you become serious about the faith. There are going to be some people. They still may be friends with you. They may not talk to you as much as they did in the past. There may be some things that they don't talk to you about any longer. They may change as far as their behavior and interaction with you. But when you become a Christian, if you're really trying to live a Christian life, it is going to have an impact on others as they deal with you. He went on to say, top of the next page, "We showed the film strips over the next coming months to anybody with a pulse and a body temperature, whether that was a pizza guy, friends, coworkers, people at gas stations, all the people that they met, and would give them just a little bit of time." He said he was trying to go forth and practice what Jesus taught in the Great Commission, and there were probably some people who thought that he'd gotten into some kind of cult, but he didn't care. Midway down, we have that next paragraph. He says, "Even though we worked hard at trying to win souls to Christ, there was not a lot of success. And they came to see that the lack of success was, in their mind, their fault." He said, "I pushed the gospel onto people who had no real interest in the message." That can be discouraging if you, especially as a younger Christian, you were trying to do that kind of thing and you were meeting wall after wall, all kinds of resistance. You're kind of thinking, well, this was the best news for me. This is the right way to live. We can establish that it's true. Why wouldn't everybody want to jump on board? And it's like anything else. You find a product which you think is life-changing. Everybody needs it. And then all of a sudden, you begin to find that very few people have the same level of interest that you do. But there's an upside to that. And what's the upside? Failure, 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 failure. Where's the silver lining?
Next time might not be.
Well, that's true, but what else?
Learning, 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 learning.
Yeah, as you fail, 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 you're learning, learning, learning. You're growing oftentimes by leaps and bounds when it comes to spiritual maturity. So if you will invest the time, the work, the effort, you'll find that there will be some good upsides to that. And that's kind of a difficult way to learn and become more mature in the faith, but it's almost a guaranteed way to learn.
People still learn in spiritual things, even though the others weren't there.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's just a matter of technique. There may be some cases where you think, I presented this, it didn't go well, and we have that today. You might have a person, especially in this area, if they're going to an RV show and they make a presentation, they make a pitch, Maybe it's to another company, or maybe you are a parts supplier. You go into a local company and you make this pitch, and maybe you're not prepared to answer some questions, or something else comes up and you foul it up and you think, wow, I blew that. There's no way that they're going to give us any of their business. Well, okay, maybe you did blow it, but still, you hopefully learned something from that, and the next client that you call on, you perhaps can win a sale there because of what you messed up previously. Don?
I was in sales for a number of years. And one of the techniques we use in sales, especially if you're doing cold call, some like low call, and you knew the clientele you were calling on, you would schedule your most highest percentage that you were going to make a sale first. Mm-hmm. Instead of going to your most difficult one, because that's discouraging, like he found out. And you sort of build up this confidence that, yeah, I'm pretty good. I can sell. I can make the sale. And then when you go to the end and the ones that don't buy, well, you know, maybe I just didn't do it right. You still don't do it because you got 10 or 15% to talk about.
I think if you were to look at the companies which are looking for people to sell knives or Tupperware or other things, and you were to go through the training programs, one of the things that you might not find in every one of those programs, but the majority of the programs, would be the idea you reach out to your friends and families first. Because they know that's probably going to be the easiest person to sell to rather than the cold call. And you have that series of successes, friends and family members, you can do it, and then you move on. And then, of course, if you fail, well, at least the company ended up with at least a few sales, and they can go on to the next salesperson. But that is a common strategy, and that does work. It does help people increase their confidence if they will start with people that they know. That may have been also something that you see with the Great Commission. Can you imagine the apostles if Jesus had said, "Will you guys run out and start talking to the Gentiles?" We're not quite ready for that. But who do they start with? Stay here in Jerusalem. People that perhaps you've known for years, you start with them, and then you can move on. Is that it? Carol?
Well, another thing, I don't remember exactly how long Randall studied with him, but it was quite a long time, and he was very resistant. He, every little nugget, he was like, he had to go back and study for himself and kind of think it over. And so he failed to remember how he felt about it when he started off.
It was. And you think sometimes, too, if we've taken a job and they've trained us, let's say that we get a two-week training period, and they say, okay, we've gone through everything. Do you understand how the machine works? Do you understand this, that, and the other thing? Yes, I've got it down. Well, it's one thing to sit in the classroom. It's one thing to be standing next to the guy as he works the machine. But what happens when you're stuck out there in the floor by yourself and now it's your sole responsibility to do it? That puts a slightly different perspective in your mind, doesn't it? You're the one who's now doing whatever needs to be done. And you can do the same thing as you mentioned, Carol. He has all this information. It takes a while for him to get it all laid out in his head. And he's got it now, but now it's his turn to go out and teach. And that becomes a little more challenging. Again, that's going to be part of the growth process. But yes. Yes.
Now,
yes.
A year later.
And people can fall into that same trap as well, and that's a problem. Is that it? Okay, let's go back and say a couple of the things, and that'll finish out the chapter. He talks about the fact that he had tried to push the gospel onto everybody who had an interest or not, and talks about the fact that he was growing spiritually. He says that he and his wife, they loved attending Bible classes. They were at the worship services. There were several young couples of the congregation that had befriended him. But then at the top of the next page, I was about to discover a disturbing secret. It was a secret that would kill my zeal and derail my desire to share the gospel with anybody. All right, well, let's see what that was. Burned bulbs. Next chapter, we're introduced to somebody else, a fellow by the name of Carter. And as you continue to read the first page of the next chapter, he talks about the fact that Carter met him at the church building. The bulbs that he was using for the projectors way back when, and this is still true sometimes. If you see the projection screens, or not the screens, but the projection units sometimes in church buildings, those bulbs may last for, I don't know, 5,000, 10,000 hours, oftentimes a long time. But when it's time to change out that bulb, ouch, it is very expensive. Projector bulbs have oftentimes been very, very costly. So he explains to this fellow by the name of Carter, this is the fifth light bulb I've blown up in many months. Midway down the page, he says, don't worry about it, Mike. These projector bulbs are made to burn very bright. They also put out a lot of heat. That's probably why they don't last very long. We reached his office, and he retrieved a new projector bulb from a tall double door cabinet. He hands me the bulb, and the price tag's been left on the box. How much was it? Yeah, that's still a reasonable amount of money, but if you back up about, what was it, 40 years ago, 1988, you're 35 to 40 years ago in that range, $20-plus dollars back then was certainly a good amount of money. And he sees the price tag and says, hey, hold on a minute. And Carter asks, what's the problem? He said, Carter, these bulbs cost $22 a piece. Yeah, it's okay. We've got to have them. And there's a little bit more of a discussion. He says, well, look, I'm not stupid. If everybody's blowing one of these bulbs every month like I am, there's no way that the church can keep on affording this. Pause there for just a second. And when we think about local congregations, I can't speak for everybody, but here, as I look back over the years, if someone has needed something as far as literature or tracts or some other things, it's available to you. Take it. You know, you're a member here. This is something that we want you to have. That's generally how things have proceeded here. But at the same time, it's also good to remember that things cost something, don't they? You know, it's like we talked about this some time ago. I think it was back with Muscle and a Shovel. People will sometimes go in and pilfer from a workplace. They're thinking, well, I need some hardware, and you've got plenty of screws and nuts and bolts, so I'm just going to go ahead and take a big fistful. And that's true for local congregation as well. You have some places, they're more than willing to provide people with the resources, the tools, whatever they need. But still, it's also good to remember that things do cost. Thought that you wanted to add or ask there or not? Okay, I thought somebody was starting to flash a hand. Going back, Shank says, I'm not stupid. If everybody's blowing these things, it's going to be really costly. And Carter says, well, now wait a minute. How many people do you think are showing the film strips like you are? Well, he tries to go through and do a little math in his head. Let's see. There are about 400 men in the congregation, so I'd say probably about 400 people. And if you take 400 people times 400 bulbs every month, and that's about $22 a bulb, then it's costing about how much a month? Yeah, close to $9,000 a month. He says, well, we don't have 400 people showing the film strips. And he looked ashamed. In fact, not only do we not have 400, we don't have anywhere close to that number. So he asks the question, he says, well, we've got, you know, congregation, how large? I don't know, maybe around 1,000 people. How many are showing them? He holds up his fingers, 2. And Shank is surprised and shocked, and he says, well, essentially, how can that be? And he said, who are those people? Well, there's me and there's you. When you think about new Christians, and this is true of so many other things, the person gets the job and they say, this is the perfect job for me. Anybody ever hear that? Anybody ever made it feel that way? Well, after 3 months or 6 months, what's true of the perfect job? Yeah. I quit. Wait a minute. Last time I saw you, you said that this was the best job ever. Oh, it was a terrible place to work. Somebody gets married. I have found the best mate. Well, what's true a year later? I found somebody else. Terrible person. And you're thinking, what happened there? Sometimes it happens with congregations. Not that people are lying, but sometimes it just takes a little while for reality to set in. And the newness of something, whatever that is, the newness of something. We buy something, we think this is great, you use it for a little while, and you're thinking, what a pain in the neck. Why'd I ever spend some hard-earned money on that? And that item that we thought that we had to have and was going to make life so much easier, it doesn't work out that way. When you have Christians, new Christians, they also can have some unrealistic expectations. They're going to think everybody loves God just like they do. Everybody is so fired up just like they do. They are. Everybody's going to be so dedicated just like they are. And they have this utopia version of the church. Now, there are all kinds of great things about the church. But it's also helpful, I think, sometimes to maybe have a little sit-down talk with people and say, look, the church consists of the people. That's what the word means. People are imperfect. And at some point in your Christian life, you're going to see some things that will reflect those imperfections. And when those times come, don't let that be a faith crisis for you. You know, we can talk about those things and work through those things, but you need to realize that not everything is always going to look like it's five stars for you. Thoughts that you have on that before we move down a little bit. Don?
I guess I'm wondering why Michael up in the other book.
Wait, wondering why? What?
Michael in the last book, the other book.
Okay, the other book.
He was a guy that asked a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. Randall, he asked questions of Randall right and left to verify if what he was saying was, you know, true. And he searched it out. But here he doesn't ask Carter, why just you and me? If you're doing it, Carter, will you do any good?
Well, let's move down a little further, and then we'll expound on that thought a bit more.
Okay.
Anybody else want to interject something at this point? Let's go back and see what we have. So, at this juncture, he's headed back to the apartment. He goes straight to the kitchen calendar, doesn't say a single word to his wife. Now, I've done that a couple times to Teresa, probably more than a couple times. And she wants to know what I'm doing. Why are you reaching for the calendar? Why are you headed for the phone? That doesn't always go well. So sometimes always better to pause and give a little extra information as far as communication before you do something. But anyway, he's the man on the mission at this point. So the date is Thursday, September 8th, 1988, and he noted on the calendar that there was an appointment for the film strips to be shown to a nice young couple. That was to be at 7 o'clock. He looks at his watch, and it's 22 minutes prior to that time. It's 6:38. Well, obviously the wife is interested in what's going on. She presses him for information. He said, I'm going to tell you, but I got to call this couple. So he does that, identifies himself, and says, look, we've got a Bible study, and that's in about 20 minutes. I can't make it tonight. I'm very sorry. Something's come up. Well, if you were the couple that received that call, you might be thinking, well, you know, I wonder who died or what happened. I mean, this would seem to be pretty important, and why are you calling off the study? So they rescheduled, ended the call, but he says, it was a lie. I would never reschedule the appointment. Well, by this time, you can imagine that his wife, she's probably taken some time to get cleaned up and, you know, rearranged her day and thinking that, okay, this is going to be another study. And now she's wondering and worried. He also says getting more impatient by the minute. We sat down. I told her that Carter and I were the only two people in the entire congregation showing the film strips. You are the only two? Yeah. The only two in the whole congregation? Yeah. Then she asked, well, why did you cancel tonight's Bible study? Evidently, those brethren of the congregation knew something that we don't, and I'm not showing any more films until we find out what that something is. Now, as you start looking at Shank's mind, you can begin to see a very logical progression. We saw a very logical progression in the first book as far as questions come up. He asks this and gets an answer. Well, if that's true, then how about this? Or if that's true, then this must be true. And it's somebody who's working through things very, very sequentially. And now he's reached the point, well, look, I was enthused about the conversion, and Jesus said, go out and tell the message. I've been doing that. I would then logically assume that everybody would be doing that, but I just learned that everybody's not doing that. So that indicates that there's a problem somewhere, and maybe there's something I don't understand. So rather than go out and study with people, I better figure this out. And that's kind of where he is. Anything that you want to add or ask before we turn the page? Yeah.
He's taken the easy road, thinking this is miraculously going to convert people, and it's not how it works, and people will figure it out.
Yeah. People do that, though, don't they? Here's somebody who struggled to get a job for 6 months. Thought. Really had to search and scratch. And then they meet somebody, and another person says, well, I'm really, oh, it'll all work out, it'll be fine, no problem. Well, no, wait, what was your experience? They just somehow forget about all the things that they went through and are dismissive of it. So it's kind of a strange quirk of humanity sometimes. Stan?
Well, there's been a lot of psychological studies done with groups of people. And you can take someone who is really confident that they know what's going on, and then they get put in with a group of people who have been prompted ahead of time to be in opposition to what this individual thought, whatever it was, and suddenly this one person finds there's a whole group of people that he's just even if recently associated with that are saying, no, it's not that way. And the studies show that very more often than not, that individual will at the very least stop what they're doing, stop their thought process, or switch to whatever the group thinks. And that sounds to me like what he's done. It's like, I have this conviction, now all of a sudden this whole group, his congregation, is indicating anyway that that's not the case, and so he simply backed up. He's now totally uncertain of what he was certain of before.
Yeah. That it? Okay, looking ahead a little bit more, he goes back to this fellow by the name of Carter, asks about this, and Carter says, it's fear. He goes on to mention in that next sentence, he said, I had arrived here unannounced, coming directly from the office after work on the hunt for that something that caused only 2 of the 900 Christians in the congregation where they were to actively share the gospel. And he gets that answer, it's fear. Fear keeps people from sharing the gospel. Well, here again, you can see the logical sequence, okay? Fear, that's my answer. But that's not necessarily a complete answer. If it's fear, then what are they afraid of? Define that a little more fully for me. Well, one of the fears would be what? The fear of questions. If I talk to somebody about something, they might ask a question. And if I'm not in a position to answer the question, maybe it's going to embarrass me. Maybe it's going to leave me humiliated. Maybe it's going to shake my faith. Who knows what? But sometimes fear is a big issue. And then he also talked about sometimes a lack of Bible knowledge. He then makes the point, he says, we've gotten away from really studying and memorizing God's Word. When people fail to build a strong knowledge of the Bible, they fear bringing it up to others. If you, and my illustration for this is going to be the hardware store. If you go into a hardware store, if you are not hardware inclined, for example, or maybe you are not an expert on paint, or maybe you're not an expert on lumber, whatever that might be, you go to the fella who looks like he knows what he's doing. Ray was working in the plumbing department for a little while at Lowe's, and he kind of looks like he knows what he's doing, and some things like that. So you go and you say, well, hey, you know, I need a pipe that is of these dimensions and of this type. And, oh, yeah, hey, that's over here in aisle 3, and there it is. But if people don't have that knowledge, you know, it's kind of like, well, don't talk to me. I don't have any knowledge of plumbing or electrical or hardware, whatever that might be. And if you have very little knowledge of Scripture, that's going to make it tough to try to reach out to people. He said when people fail to build a strong Bible knowledge, they fear bringing it up to others. Well, again, the logical question is fear. Fear of what? Well, fear of questions. Fear because they don't have a lack of knowledge, and that's because they don't study. The next logical question would be what? Why don't they study? I mean, you can, again, see this as far as a very sequential line of thought. Well, in his mind, that seemed pretty black or white. But, again, being young, naive when it came to Christianity, and not naive in a bad way, but just as far as how things sometimes are. Well, he smiles and says, that's a great question. Let's get something to eat. We talked about this a little bit. I'm going to go back. Usually don't try to backtrack too much in class, but I'm going to backtrack for just a second to last Sunday where we're talking about clergy and laity. Carol brought up a question as far as you have somebody who's insisting on using a title. And my answer to that was sometimes just use humor. When that question was asked, and Don was also part of that discussion, I was thinking in terms of kind of a one-time deal where you meet somebody, for example, you're at a funeral, and the guy says, call me Pastor so-and-so. But Teresa, on the way home, she said, I had a much different take on that. She said, I was thinking about that in terms of a long, an extended relationship. You're going to see this person again and again and again. And she gave me a specific, for instance, in her life. And she said, if you try to use humor in that kind of situation, it is not going to go over very well. And I said, you're exactly right. But that wasn't where my mind was when that question was being addressed. So that would take us back to Don's comment. And that would be, Don made the point that there are going to be some times we actually have to say, I can't do that in good conscience because of what the Bible says. And if that's not enough for them, then you could actually start laying out some passages. Now, I tell you all that to not only go back and clean up that point a little bit, but also to make this point. Sometimes when that kind of discussion comes up, rather than just say, okay, we're going to flesh it out, we're going to have the discussion right now, probably need a little more time for it, so let's do what? All right, or let's go out to eat. You know, it's kind of late, and let's have some time to go out and visit for a little while. Maybe change the atmosphere a little bit and go out and find another place to talk. So that's what he did, and I think that probably was a very good call. Anything that you want to add or ask on that point? Okay, so they head over to the pizza shop, and it was packed Friday night. He made three trips to the buffet, finally got full, and then they go back to the question, Carter, what should we do? He said, I was discouraged. When we start thinking about new Christians, that's always an important point to remember. You find when Jesus gave the parable of the sower and the seed, you see how delicate that seed can be. And sometimes things like discouragement, sometimes learning how things are in some congregations, as far as you find some Christians who are not all that committed, very, very discouraging to new Christians, and that's something to always be watchful of and mindful of. Michael, it's been a fundamental change for the last few decades. Life is busier now. People are caught up in the daily grind. They have careers, they have kids, they have ball games, there's ballet practice, there's TV, all kinds of things. When we look at our society, I mean, you don't have to look very far to find all kinds of items that compete for time. You can fill up your weeks in so many ways. And literally, every hour that you're not asleep, you could put something in there. And even if we had 24 hours of waking time, 7 days a week, it could still be full. Now, again, looking at this in terms of a very black and white response, what's he say? Carter goes through all the reasons why people are sometimes not all that involved. And Shanks says what? They are just excuses. Well, you can once again see he just, almost like a child, slices right to the heart of the matter. Was he right? Yes. In many respects, yes. And then Carter goes back and says, yes, you are correct. But that's the reality of the life we live today. And that is true. You have some congregations which do better when it comes to cooperation, help from members, involvement, than some other places. It's going to vary from location to location. But this is an issue in virtually every congregation. He said, I'm not defending the excuses. I'm only pointing out the obstacles that we have to deal with. Know where we are, understand it, and then hopefully you're better prepared to deal with it. He said, your willingness to go out and share the gospel has been a great encouragement to fellow Christians. He says, and I'm going to highlight this a little bit, I was only doing what you said everyone else was doing, interrupting a second time. This is another thing that you find sometimes with people, especially those who maybe are new Christians or new to a job. Because they're processing so many things, it's possible for them to hear something, and maybe it's not expressed in the best way, or maybe it is expressed in such a way, but they don't have enough of a knowledge base to hear it in such a way where they get the exact point. And sometimes, if you don't hear something exactly right, can it be exactly wrong? Yeah. And that was the case here. I really have a difficult time believing that Carter said everybody there was showing the film strips. Now, maybe he did say that, but to me that seems unlikely. It seems to me that he was trying to explain, and Shank sort of reads between the lines a little bit and doesn't read very well. He draws this conclusion. So he makes the point. He says, I'm sorry, I thought you were asking if showing the film strips was something you should be doing. I didn't realize it gave you the impression that everyone in the congregation was showing the studies. He says, well, okay, I misunderstood, and there's another reminder about not being discouraged. He says, again, as far as a reminder about the encouragement, I don't think that you realize the great effect, the positive effect that you've been having on the Christians at the congregation. And then he says this, so what? Interrupting for a third time. It's not causing them to do anything, is it? But once again, you can see the very logical progression, thinking through things almost like a child. It's amazing sometimes how logical kids can be. Parents say something, and boy, the child has instantly thought that through and comes back. They offer a snappy comeback, and you think, well, okay. You know, I'm going to let you score the point there because technically you're right. But it goes back to, again, understanding the times that we live in and trying to teach people better behavior. He says, Michael, don't let anybody's inactivity dictate your passion for the lost. And that's right. Every person is individual. We all make our choices. And the good should influence us to do things in the right way. And bad, just shake that off and keep going. Anything that you want to add or ask before we start highlighting some points from Mark 4? Okay, give us a scripture from Mark 4. Notice some things. He talks about the sower. That would be the Christian. Sowing the word. That would be God's word. And he talks about the fact that there are some people, the word sown, and when they've heard, who shows up? The devil. And notice the next word. How quickly does the devil come?
Immediately.
I find that to be an interesting statement. How does that work? Is Satan out there with his helpers looking to see where Bible studies take place?
So they go back and forth like a little
Yeah, you have to wonder a little bit. It seems like that's one of the things that is on his agenda.
Always on the lookout
for where God's word is being preached and taught and instilled in the hearts of people. So that's an amazing thing about the devil. Not amazing in a good way, but amazing as far as what he tries to undo. Sure.
I mean, here you are, you're just converted, you're all excited, and you take off, your car breaks down. You get all excited, and you take off, and the kids have to go to the dentist, there's an emergency, you know. So it's just one thing after another. Mm-hmm. He has lots and lots of helpers.
It is, and he does have a lot of tools, a lot of helpers, but that's what he wants to do, is quickly, before that really begins to take root. And not only does it show up quickly, what's he want to do? He wants to take it away. Completely remove it, just like yanking seeds out of the ground, even though it was sown in the hearts. And then Jesus goes on to talk about the seed that was sown in stony ground. And he, again, uses the word immediately. It's sown there. Immediately, people receive it with gladness. They do take it. And they're thrilled that they heard it. But what happens as far as the spiritual root that they have? He says, there's how much root?
No.
No root whatsoever. And he says they can endure for a little while. But then there's something that comes up. There's an affliction, persecution, and it arises because of the word's sake. And how quickly are they offended? Immediately. And then he talks about those that are sown among the thorns, and they hear the word, but then there are the cares of this world. And Shank certainly was affected by some of that. You have the deceitfulness of riches. He was affected by that, at least for a time. And then you have other less. They choke the word. It becomes unfruitful. And then you have those that are sown on good ground. They hear the word. They receive it. They bring forth good fruit, 30-fold, 60-fold, and some 100-fold. I spent some time with Stan earlier this morning. We had a couple hours together. And as we were talking about different things, I let him know that it's been about a year. Remember the church shooting in Tennessee? Burnett congregation? I don't know exactly that it's been, you know, 365 days, but we're pretty close to the anniversary mark of that. And there was a member of the congregation who was shot. She was a lady, shot in the leg. And as I read a little bit about the article that somebody had that resulted from an interview, she said, I've not gone back to services. And I thought, how sad. Now, I can understand that you might be traumatized from that, and there might be some other things that would cause you to be skittish and some other things. I don't know what she's done with the rest of the Christian faith. I'm assuming that she was a Christian. It sounded like it from the article. I pulled up a picture of her to kind of see if I could guess her age. I'm guessing that she's around 70, maybe a couple years shy of that, maybe a couple years after that. But her health looked like it was good enough where I'm assuming that she could drive or make it out to services without a lot of undue assistance. And yet she said, you know, I haven't gone back. And I thought, how sad. And yet, does the devil care how he gets you out?
No.
I mean, shooting? Hey, that works for me, speaking for Satan. Discouragement? That works for me. Too big, too small, people don't talk to you, people talk to you too much. The devil doesn't care how it works. The end result is the only thing that he's concerned about. But there are so many things that can choke out the word of God from a life. He goes on to say, Michael, the church's biggest challenge is described in verse 19, and the cares of this life, the deceitfulness of riches, the lust of other things entering in, choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. Ignorance of God's word causes fear. The devil can use that as well. He says, Carter, how do we get our brothers and sisters to study? Well, the answer, he said, is encouragement. We become like Barnabas. Well, again, here's another piece of information that apparently was new to him. And it's, well, okay, who's that guy Barnabas? And he explains, well, we read about him in Acts chapter 4. His name was Joseph, but they began to call him Barnabas. Why? Because Barnabas means son of encouragement. So Carter stands up, tosses a $5 bill on the table for a tip, puts his arm around me and says, now come on, Barnabas, we've got a lot of work to do. As I walk by the buffet, I grab one last slice of ham and pineapple. He gave me a funny look. Hey, I laughed. It's for the road. You might want to study gluttony, said Carter as he laughed his way out of the restaurant. Yeah, well, you're no Barnabas yourself, I responded. However, storm clouds were brewing, spiritual storm clouds. Thoughts that you want to add or ask before we shut it down tonight? Ray?
I just think that shooting down there in Tennessee